Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
What say you, Richard Philip Murdoch? Are you guilty or not guilty of the felonies wherein you stand indicted?
Not guilty.
How shall you be tried?
By God and my country.
The exact time when Paul and Maggie Murdoch were murdered.
At the end of the investigation, it was obvious.
I'm not here to work with them, okay?
And the whole point is to have this not fall into the wrong hands. This case is unique, it's unprecedented in South Carolina history.
I'm mad as hell. I mean, you just don't know how mad I am. But on the other hand, I'm not saying that because he did that, he's done what he's accused of.
Welcome to Unsolved South Carolina, the Murdoch Murders Money and Mystery. I'm Ann Emerson. I'm joined by our exclusive legal analyst, Charlie Condon, who is also South Carolina's former attorney general. I have our executive producer, Drew Tripp, here, who has been live blogging this whole fascinating day, 22, week 5 of the Murdoch trial, and we have Max Harrison running all the production and also fielding questions on some of our live streams that we have. And of course, you find us on our podcast streams tonight as well. I want to go straight into what we just heard was Mark Ball. He was a defense witness, we thought. So basically he was brought in by the defense, and I don't mean that lightly, but seriously, the way he testified, he could have been on either side at one point. What do you think about how did that go down, Charlie?
I just thought that it was brilliantly handled by Assistant Attorney General Creighton Waters. He turned him from a defense witness. And he did say some things helpful to the defense, but what I think everyone's going to remember, in particular the jurors, would be the cross-examination by Creighton Waters. He had really good, what I call, pace and tone. He had volume up and down, and he conducted, that's the word I would use, he conducted a planned out, very effective cross-examination on this witness that I believe went much longer than the direct examination. And by the end of it, I saw Attorney Ball as a very, very powerful witness for the state of South Carolina. And what Creighton Waters did with him is he went through in very detailed fashion, really the egregious breaches of trust by this defendant. That'd be the way I think I would characterize it, that he just did everyone wrong, so to speak, over an extended period of time and really bolstered the state's theme throughout this trial is that people who thought they knew Alec Murdoch, in fact, did not know him. And it was a masterful performance. I thought it was brilliant. And if I had to rank attorney performances thus far, and I do want to disclaim he actually was appointed as an assistant attorney general during my term as attorney general,
sure.
So I want to put that out there. But I'd have to rank it certainly, if not at the top, near the top.
Oh, that's fascinating. Drew, I wanted to play the clip. Did you have something to add before I play the clip of Mark Ball?
No, I just a little bit to the point that Charlie first made about he also scored some points for the defense, right? And it became very obvious today the defense's strategy. And to use something that if you've followed along on Twitter with me today, as I've just kind of been offering commentary aside from the live blog, it was very evident the state put SLED on trial today. They were putting SLED and their investigation.
The
defense. They were putting the state's investigation on trial and putting it out there for the jury to see and really, really hammering that home. They've tried to make since day one.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. And that's the, you know, there's an old South Carolina saying, if you don't have the facts on your side, try the law. If you don't have the law on your side, try the prosecutor or try the state. So I think that's exactly right. I did think as a defense strategy, and again, practicing criminal defense and being actively involved with that, it can work.
And yeah, I thought Mark Ball, from that perspective, he was just, he was so observant and so keen as to what he was seeing, and being immediately taken aback by what was going on. And like, are you sure? He brought up the anecdote of Coroner Richard Harvey coming up and saying, hey, sled's here. You guys got to leave the crime scene, going up to the house. And he's like, wait. You mean the house isn't the crime scene too? Are you sure we should go to the house? I thought it was doubly effective, but at the end of the day, back to Charlie's original point, and he was turned. He was turned right before everyone's very eyes, and he became a very, very strong asset for the state in prosecution.
Well, let's play the clip, because he takes us all the way through the... There was so much from Mark Bault. I mean, oh my gosh, we did stories on it. You've got a live blog. Mm-hmm. We talked about it in our... But there was so much, because as Drew just said, and it was my biggest note on him, he practically had a photographic memory. He took you back to the moment all of this went down. He would tell you where he was sitting, what he was thinking when it happened, what was the weather like, or that he was sitting on a tractor when he first heard about something. And maybe because these things were so traumatizing, that's why.
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting. Most, sometimes said that lawyers can sometimes make the worst witnesses in a way, but he was the sort of witness that when you asked him a question, he would answer it, right, then he would give all sorts of extra information. So from that standpoint, I just really thought the state had a field day with him. And the defense made some points, but I just thought he was just great. I mean, the color that he had relative to the criminal activity of Defendant Murdoch was, I thought, just so, gosh, it just made him look so bad.
It was devastating. Mm-hmm. Well, let's listen. This is basically, I think this clip basically takes us to September, when Mark Ball is still, I think, holding on to that Alec is a victim, and Alec is his friend, and Alec would never do anything to betray him, and that he was just there trying to figure out who killed Maggie and Paul.
I would have never believed that a guy that was like family would have ever stolen from me, would have stolen from his family, would have stolen from his clients, or any of that. You've got this rage, this emotion that you've got, and then on the third, we go through this whole ordeal of the termination, and then the fourth, it hits, and you're like, you know, did the jack kill himself?
Yeah, we bleeped that part, because he said it a couple of times in court, but yeah, I mean, he was like, basically, did he really just try and kill himself? I mean, that was basically what he was saying, and it did not sound like... He was so upset about what he had discovered at the firm. It really, I don't understand exactly why the defense would have called somebody that was obviously speaking to the state so much. Creighton Waters even said a couple of times, well, we talked about this, Mark. We talked about this. And I'm like, wait a minute, but he's the defense's witness.
Yeah, you know, I've been on both sides of that, and I don't think they'll call a similar witness, because it is true, when you're prosecuting cases, and I know I've done this many, many times, you can actually get lots of information from a defense witness that proves the state's case, and so that goes without saying. So I know that the defense attorneys knew this, but I guess I am to share your train of thought that obviously he'd been so cooperative with both sides that the information that they must have known that he had was going to be brought out by Prosecutor Waters. And wow, did he, again, I hate to keep harping on this, but it wasn't just that he brought it out. It was the pause. He started off strong, and then the pause, and then he looked at the jury at key moments, and his voice went up and down at the right moments. He commanded that courtroom. There were no objections from the defense, because I'm a little bit surprised they didn't try to break him up some, but I knew Judge Newman would allow it. So he had, what was it, an hour and a half or so of negative information on the defendant?
Mm-hmm. I was watching the jury in there, and I just have to say, they looked upset, especially when we were talking about the financial victims. These were the vulnerability.
Yeah, they were friends with Alex, and how he knew them.
Friend that had cancer.
Yeah, and the one that needed the money for housing or something, for his wife was dying or something.
So, and you can bet that scored some points with the people who have been watching this trial as spectators, because one of the big threads in this like untied, unconnected dots in all this was the Alec Murdoch Barrett Boulder connection. And
didn't your ears go up?
Immediately. And this was a Fitz News story way back in 2021, trying to, you know, tie all the way back to Operation Jackpot and make the connection between Boulder and Murdoch, and kind of going a little bit into Boulder's background. And he owned
Moselle, didn't he?
He owned Moselle before Alec did. And it comes out today, and I think they got into it a little bit with Jeannie Seckinger, that, you know, there's this implication of what might Alec and Barrett have been up to as buddy-buddy good pals with all their land deals and things like that. And that's fine. That's a perfectly plausible avenue of exploration when you're trying to piece this together and piece together motive as an investigative journalist. But when they said, oh, yeah, by the way, this guy who maybe has a little bit of a checkered past who Alec had close ties to, yeah, he stole from him, too. While he was dying of colon cancer, and he needed money for his wife to have a place to stay where while he was in the hospital so she could be with him, Alec stole from them too.
Allegedly.
And he had Mark Ball go over that.
Right.
It was very effective. That was the innuendo. That was the insinuation. Mm-hmm. Creighton didn't say that, obviously. But if you've been following along with the that immediately, like Ann said, it perked my ears up. And then Creighton got to dig into a little old lady, little sweet old lady Murdoch stole from. Just little things like that all throughout. Aww. Just really
face. The jury just was watching this go down. And I guess they had heard about the vulnerability from Tony Satterfield and some of the other, people about the victims. But for whatever reason, this just kind of really dug in there. We're so late into the trial right now to hear that from a defense witness.
And this clip, as I recall, too, when the Jack Blank came out, that was in reference to where the roadside shooting. And Creighton made the point again was, well, here he's talking about being a victim again. And you got this, I just thought it was very powerful, because then it was, oh, yeah, he keeps using that when he in effect is involved with acts of violence.
And this is their motive, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is what they're trying to make that.
Back to the allegations or the states, you know, that he committed, he would, the unthinkable became thinkable in Alec Murdoch's world.
Right.
So it was,
a moment.
Yeah. And I know these jurors are not supposed to use this information. It's motive only, not character assassination. But again, I'm confident they will do their duty, but that's going to be a challenge.
And you saw Alec's face.
Yeah. After Mark Ball. I made a point about that. But to Charlie's point, at what, you can use kind of like a horseshoe analogy, a upside down horseshoe where it makes this motion. At what point at the bottom of that horseshoe does character and motive intersect a little bit with, and I think that's what we're getting. We're kind of almost backing our way into it a little bit. And I think one of the ways we got there with Mark Ball was his testimony. And this also goes to your point, Ann, about the effectiveness of Mark Ball and the jury, his testimony about Paul. And it was strong when Ronnie Crosby gave it, and it was strong when we've heard other people give it. But Mark Ball got up there and talked so glowingly. He talked honestly about Paul Murdoch. And he said that he was a wonderful young man with devilish ways, and he had so much potential, unmet potential. He was a good boy, and he would do anything in the world for you. And so did Barbara Mixon to that point. We've repeatedly heard it over, but Mark Ball's testimony about Paul and that in particular, I think might have been the thing more than anything, more than the little old ladies that hooked the jury. And I think it does at a certain point. the character, the character goes beyond the motive, and the motive goes beyond the character, and they can't, you can't go have one without the other a little bit. And I think is what the point I feel like I'm trying to make with that a little bit. And how do you consider one without the other at this point?
And I don't think you can you? I mean, you're a human
being.
Well,
law is full of many, what's the word I would use, legal theories and maxim. And so I know Judge, in fact, he instructed them three times already, hasn't he, on this evidence to only be considered for motive and not for anything else. But I must say, in this trial, I don't know if I've ever been involved with something, and it's been, we're in the fifth week, and the amount of negative information on this defendant is massive, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
I mean, just massive. Forget the allegations of murder. And just from my standpoint, also being involved with representing victims of, you know, from a civil standpoint, wrongful death cases and things, I kept thinking during the trial, the only thing worse that a lawyer could do from stealing from someone like Tony Satterfield would be murder.
Yeah.
And he's, both of these are out there with the jurors. Now, but having said that, I will say these jurors of every day have been very attentive. I'm confident they will follow the judge's instructions to the best of their ability, but they need to keep that in mind, that the instructions need to be first and foremost in that jury room, and they need to follow them, because it is true, they're not supposed to use it for character. They're just not. I mean, the character is not supposed to be used as proof of propensity to commit a crime or that he did, in fact, commit the crime.
Do you think we got so...
The negative character events.
Do you think we got so far down that road today because it was cross-examination? And I think I've heard it stated that cross-exam is wide open. Yes. I think you even said that last night.
Yeah, it is in this state. But, you know, let's assume there is a state's verdict and he's found guilty. The clear main issue on appeal is going to be this letting in this financial information. But I must say, some of the moves by the defendant where they, Judge Newman talked about it, like, you gone across this bridge. I was going to keep this evidence out. And you went across the bridge.
Pulled a road over the bridge.
Yeah, over the bridge. There is this also concept on appeal, harmless error. That, wait a minute. Now, it may not have been exactly right what the rulings, but here we are. It's since you brought it up, and as part of your defense strategy, that's another possible way this could result in appeal. But I've had cases reversed many times when I was prosecuting, and I must say, you try and, I learned on capital cases in particular, to kind of hold back, because you got to retry these cases. And I think they would retry this case if he's found guilty and then reversed on appeal. But I feel like at this part of the emotional part of this trial, that they're going for the, you know, they want to put the evidence in they think is admissible. I don't think they think that defense is inviting error, so to speak. So I feel like they're being as aggressive as they need to be or want to be within the rules. I think they feel like they're safe. I do think the defense thinks they've got something on appeal. So that's going to be something, if there is a guilty verdict, well, about a year and a half from now.
Well, speaking of defense strategy, I mentioned earlier, you know, they want to put the sled on trial, basically, the defense did. And to that end, Anne, we got some other defense strategy. And Charlie, we got some other, I feel like, defense strategy we need to go over there. Are we ready to go there now?
I think we do need to go there because we are all sort of waiting with bated breath to see if the other lawyer sitting, or the former lawyer sitting at their table, actually wants to take the stand.
I'll say.
Max, do we have that?
I am not going to issue an order in advance limiting the scope of cross-examination. Any objectionable matter must be addressed as the evidence is presented and not based on any advance ruling by the court.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
All right, so that was Judge Newman's ruling this morning in response to Jim Griffin and the defense trying to get ahead And Charlie, I want to toss it right over to you to get a better explanation of this. But essentially, Jim Griffin and the defense trying to get ahead of the possibility of them putting Alec Murdoch on the stand by limiting the scope of what he can be questioned about. Is that
yeah,
a fair assessment?
Did you catch it too, that Jim said in advance, I need to know this information so we can advise the defendant whether mm-hmm. or not to testify. So it really wouldn't surprise me if Alec himself might have been saying, hey, go out there and get this advisory ruling so they can't ask me about it, so therefore I really should be testifying. I think there's some internals there that might be fascinating to know if we ever could know someday. But again, Judge Newman fan club, I thought the way he handled that was brilliant. It was brilliantly done because he allowed the argument to take place. He allowed Creighton Waters to respond, and he had cases. He was ready for the moment. And he did what I thought was exact right ruling. Don't issue an advisory ruling. Wait till it comes up in court. But you kind of got the feeling, didn't you think that he was going to let Creighton fully cross-examine?
Yeah. Well, I do, and I also wonder if, in my mind, in my suspicious mind, I'm wondering, is Griffin and Harpootlian doing this so that they can't be held liable, or however you put it, with their defendant? Because, you know, if Alec Murdoch chooses to take the stand, it felt very much like Griffin, this is just my layman's, he's looking at the judge saying, see, look, Alec, I can't protect you. I can't protect you from what's going to happen in this courtroom if you choose to take the stand, because it is unusual. And I think most defense attorneys doing their job would say, be careful. This is just,
absolutely.
This is a hornet's
absolutely.
Nest.
Absolutely. I feel confident they're advising him not to testify, and it wouldn't surprise me if he really wants to get up there. And regardless of how this goes, I think we're going to see a very interesting procedure, not in front of the jury, whereby there'll be a discussion with between the court and the defendant and his attorneys on whether or not he testifies or doesn't testify. And that's to protect the record. I think it's fair to everyone because it's a key moment in this trial. I do think for him to have a chance of getting a not guilty verdict that he would need to come across as a good witness. He's got ears, as you said before, about other matters, and he's got to know that the evidence, particularly after today, I thought it feels like the jury is not going his way. Again, it's difficult to predict what 12 people will do, but I do think that they're going to want to put on the record whatever decision is made by this defendant that is his decision after being advised by his attorneys, and that he himself makes the decision.
Well, and the idea that Alec Murdoch takes the stand is so salacious, honestly.
Right.
I mean,
wow. Yeah.
After all this. Yeah. Wow. Wait, we got a question. Max, yes. Tell us.
From the prosecution standpoint, how do you prepare for such a high-level testimony?
That's a great question.
That's such a great question. Well, the first thing you want to do for something like this is making sure you're well rested, and a little exercise doesn't hurt. On top of that, this is a key moment in any criminal case, I think maybe in the history of South Carolina, because you've got a very able defendant. He's a former attorney, former prosecutor. He's going to know what you're going to come at him with. He apparently does have the gift of gab, as everyone describes. I've never met him, but people
trades
describe
in,
him.
Trades in people. What was it?
Yeah.
Trades in relationships,
yeah,
basically.
And so, yeah, and so and it wouldn't surprise me if he has some sort of understanding of the dynamics of the workings of the current state of thinking in the courtroom, so to speak. Mm-hmm. In other words, I noticed him, he's very active in advising the attorneys, mm-hmm. very talkative with them. So how do you prepare for this? There's nothing that beats actually going through and sounding off of other people. I call them themes. And I'm sure if you notice, Creighton today had this yellow pad. What I liked about what he did with his cross-examination, he just didn't walk up there and wing it. Mm-hmm. He had an ordered, prepared direction on where he conducted it. Mm-hmm. And I'm certain right now, I'd be just shocked if he doesn't have a notebook right now, yellow pad, with themes on how to show the jurors that this defendant is guilty of murder. And off the top of my head, I can think of so many, But I do keep coming back to the kennel video. I mean, I think that one, I would expect he would play it.
Is that your voice? Is that your voice?
Boom. You might have even start off with that one. Mm-hmm. And then you could go through motivations and world falling apart and the people don't know Alex. And there's so many things, but great question. But preparation would be the key.
And that is very interesting to me because there is a part of me, that, again, being a little suspicious and not totally trusting all the process, but could this be a red herring trying to send the prosecution off on this, like, we need to prepare for the next couple of days for this Alec Murdoch eventual defendant testifying? That would take so much work for the prosecution to have to be ready for him, right?
I personally think that is part of what's going on from the defense attorneys, but I also am sort of picking up a vibe, and maybe I'm wrong on this, but he really does want to testify. I think he really does.
Okay.
And just given his background, if you think about it, successful attorney, prosecutor.
Last case.
Yeah, and he's got to know, again, let's talk about what I say is a vibe in the courtroom, anybody, but I think someone with his background in particular, and I'm assuming, right, that he would have access to other people talking with him besides his attorneys. I don't know if he's allowed to take jail calls or whatever, but he's got a lot of family supporting him, and I think they're giving him perspective like, hey, Alec, what about this or that? We need to, you know, where it stands, I don't think you're getting a defense verdict. I would think there's some very sharp... I mean, he's got a lot of talented people. For what you might think of the Murdochs, and I realize that a lot of people might paint the family with a broad brush, but they do have some talented people in that family, no question. They're supporting him. So I would think they'd give him some perspective on where the case stands right now.
I think so. Go ahead.
Here's my thought, and this is the thing I wanted to get to.
Oh, yeah.
Here we go.
Inside tease. You know, we're talking every day before we come on the air, or before we start recording, before we start streaming, before we start recording. We try to talk a little bit, but we also try to limit what we're talking about to preserve some of it. I'll get to that in a second, what I wanted to ask you about. But here's where my head's going. And this is building off of what the two of you were just saying. He's had, what, now almost 2 full years to think about his alibi, and he gave it, and the one he gave for a while ended up coming back to bite him, and it's consistently coming back to bite him right now. But he's had a long time in jail to think about how to explain some of these loopholes. He's had a long time off drugs to have a clear mind and think about how he presents himself, and he is, again, he has the gift of gab, and he has he does have a legal knowledge that we most lay persons don't have. He's got access to the minds of his defense attorneys. He's formulating a plan as he goes along, and if you watch him, he's very clearly involved in it. And with all that in mind, to counter Charlie's point a little bit, you don't think he testifies, but... And I asked this to my friends over at the Post and Courier table in the media room this evening, right before we left. What does Alex have to lose by not? But what does he have to lose by testifying? I mean, if it's going so badly for him, he's already going to spend the rest of his life in jail on the financial crimes. The only people I think that really have anything to lose are Jim Griffin and Dick Arputlian. Their case gets blown up because then it hurts their business, right? But what does Alex have to lose by getting up there and testifying?
I've been thinking that too. And I don't think I don't know his state. I don't really feel like I know his state of mind. And I wonder how this is going to affect his relationship with Buster, with John Marvin, with Randy. If he just gets up there and says, I didn't do it, does that help him with them?
You know,
I don't know.
I think you might have persuaded me here, Drew, because it is true under the financial crimes, I think life without parole is a definite possibility if the state prosecutes it in a certain way. And he's got this legacy, right? I mean, that's what's the only thing left with him would be to try and salvage that he didn't. I mean, it's talk about a low standard, right? But if he can salvage that he didn't kill his wife and son, and even if he gets convicted, he can at least say, and a lot of people think this, if I didn't do it, I would sure talk. and sure testify. And so the negative evidence against him is already out there. I think an obvious explanation he might offer would be, I was so much in shock, my mind must have gone blank with the shock of seeing my wife. He's very good at crying. So we can expect a lot of emotion on there. So I think you might have something there. What's he got to lose?
And then
it's like a Hail Mary at this point.
Well, and also it's an outreach to his son and other family members that, hey, I've been telling you I didn't do it. And here I'm testifying and I know it looks bad, but I didn't do it. Yeah. And just this is my story and I'm sticking to it. And it would have a certain, I think, reason for doing it. I think it makes a lot of sense what you're saying.
And it could go horribly wrong, because what if he gets up there and just says, nope, wasn't me on the video. And is in at that point.
I can't imagine do that. He said,
there are definitely scenarios where I could accept that
I was mistaken. I thought I wasn't back there and I was so whatever traumatized by it.
That would be
post-traumatic stress disorder type thinking.
That would be my next line of thinking is, how does he explain it away? How does he explain the kennel video and the other lies?
Where did he
put his clothes?
Yeah. Well, how does he explain it?
Do you think he could take gallery questions? Because I'd like to ask him a couple of questions while he's up there. I'd like to know. I just want to know.
You can see the jurors probably like to do it too as well, but it's not allowed under procedure.
Is it right in front of our face? Is his alibi going to be out? Well, I was high. I was out of my mind, stoned on opioids, and I don't have a good reason for why I said I wasn't there. And I just don't remember anything.
The housekeeper did help him, didn't you? Think we forgot? We didn't have time to talk about that much. But the housekeeper testifying that she wanted him to visit his mom that night.
That did help a little bit.
That did help.
And shifting gears here to the point, coming full circle of, you know, what was the defense trying to accomplish today, which is to poke holes in how SLED and forensic analysts handled the investigation. It was plodding. It was slow. It was excruciating, as, in my opinion, most of the examinations or cross-examinations by Phil Barber have been so far, just because he's so all over the place. That's my editorial comment for this evening. But in Phil Barber's direct exam of the defense forensic expert on cell phones that they brought today, he got clear answers that SLED didn't have and could have had. Hey, why did Maggie's camera turn on? I don't know. We didn't look at the data. Going all the way back to Brett Dove, I don't know. We didn't look at that data. Phil Barber for the defense brings up this guy from Cleveland County, North Carolina, and is like, hey, why did the phone camera turn on? Well, if you go into this metadata on this and this, open this spreadsheet, it's got a code, and I followed the code, and it says clearly that somebody opened that camera from the lock screen of the phone. Like, they pressed on the camera button and swiped it open and then immediately closed it. There's a metadata for everything. Mm-hmm. Just little things like that that weren't answered by SLED. And again, I've also, at the same time, while I'm making that point, SLED's not on trial. They are to an extent. Obviously, they are to an extent. SLED is on trial and the investigation and how they handled it. But the blows, it feels like the blows landed by the defense along. Yeah, they explain away some things, but they don't explain away the big things. And how are you going to explain away the big things at this point unless you put Alec Murdoch up there to come up with a story?
Yeah. And by the way, did you catch how I guess it was John Meadows tried to tie in Collodin County Sheriff's Office and SLED, like, hey, the locals here, and I probably disagree on this. I actually think overall that law enforcement's been great in this case.
Yeah.
I mean, here we're in the middle of, you know, rural South Carolina, and great response. People got there, and yes, mistakes were made in hindsight, but wow, I mean, what they did, I guess I'm tend to be maybe more supportive of law enforcement than most, but I thought they did a great job overall.
I think they could have done more, and I think we made that point today.
Yes.
I think we heard that. Mm-hmm. Somebody actually said it out loud. I can't remember exactly who it was, but they said, yeah, we could have done more. Maybe it was Mark Paul.
Well,
that more should have been done.
No, that was Dick Harpootlian the forensic crime scene expert from New Haven, Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And he was excellent, by the way. I thought he handled both John Meadows and Dick Harpootlian very well. Like, No. You're not gonna trip me up and make me sound like I said something I didn't say. He handled that very well. Put a pin in this. I want to ask you about John Meadors and come back to that. But to my point I don't honestly think Charlie, you and I are that far apart on SLED. I think there are some things that just to have a impenetrable, impregnable case that are in hindsight very obvious that they could have and should have done.
Sure. Yeah.
But I think at the end of the day, the balance, the scales are way, 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 way tipped in the state's favor, and that's because of work SLED has done and these forensic analysts have done. So I'm not saying that they failed completely or to a substantial extent that they're not going to get a conviction here because of it. It has just belabored the point and opened the door so much to doubt. And how big is doubt in a case like this? Mm-hmm. That's my one point on that. But John Meadors, when he got up there and he started cross-examining Mr. Zerse from New Haven, Connecticut, and said, "Mr., wouldn't you just love to be in Laura Rutland's shoes?" And he's like, "Who's Laura Rutland?" "Oh, you don't know who Laura Rutland is? I thought you examined all the defenses. I thought you examined all the case files from this." "No, I just examined what the defense gave me." "Oh, so you haven't read through all the state's work." And this, here again, to your point about the work that SLED actually did and the law enforcement actually did. Oh, that, I thought that was brilliant.
That was such a trap.
Clever.
Yeah, it was. That was, I don't know. At this point, it's becoming Dick versus John Meadors, Jim versus Creighton a little bit. And then it's the kind of the underneath players under the, and just, oh, did we end up with this soundbite?
We sure did. So this, let's set this up. Go ahead, Drew. I'll let you set this up.
Oh, it's just the best. Where, you know, we'll go back to yesterday and throughout the trial, really, every attorney at some point has gone up very close to the witness stand to talk with him. There's a little doorway. You can see it on the camera. They go up and talk to him in the door and they back up in the doorway a little bit and talk, you know, looking over the shoulder, right side by side with him so the jury can see. And Dick Harpootlian, because he cannot help himself, he's physically incapable of making the worst possible joke at the worst possible times. And he's demonstrated that ever since I first seen him on camera, however many months ago. He made a very off-color joke toward the state's prosecution table yesterday. And let's go into the soundbite from there.
"Well, you said they were doing that.
They were standing up, badgering this witness next to him. He can read it. He can comment from back here. He's in the doorway, but again, I object."
"For clarity,
this moment, he's been the objection here. Is to you standing in the doorway.
He's been standing up here the whole time. Aimed a gun at us yesterday from here. He aimed a gun at us from here yesterday.
No, I don't believe good for the goose, good for the gander is a rule, and I can't find it in my rule book."
"Well, we're operating with limited space. Just as a matter of trial procedure, it's extremely unusual for counsel to stand in the locations where counsel have been standing throughout the trial. But given the limited space, that's somewhat understandable. But he has moved to the podium. Go right ahead."
I know. So basically, he was saying that Meadors had to move back to the podium and have his back to the gallery. And Meadors likes to be up close and personal with the jurors and with the witnesses to be able to tell his points. But yeah, it was great. We've had courtroom theatrics, and if anyone, you know, if you've been watching what's been going on these feeds, it really is something to watch. And we're gonna have more tomorrow.
Yes. It went to end on. That was a moment.
It would not surprise me. I would be equally unsurprised that John Meadors and Dick Harpootlian hate each other than if they were best of friends outside of court. And that's the type of relationship we're seeing here. I don't know. Just that's my last thing for today.
It's work, right? They're lawyers, and this is work, and they're at their place of business.
Yeah,
and we're all We're all just watching it, aren't we? So tomorrow we've got a whole nother day to watch and see what happens and see who takes the stand and who doesn't take the stand. So we will be bringing you more on this podcast tomorrow night from all of us at Unsolved South Carolina. Thank you so much for watching and listening. If you have enjoyed this, please send us a little love with a 5-star rating and maybe a review on one of your favorite platforms with podcasts. We'd love to, basically helps everybody find our podcast. So we're hoping that you can do that. Also, please keep an eye out for Unsolved South Carolina, Finding Brittany Drexel. It's also under this franchise. It's on a different stream. Check it out if you like Unsolved South Carolina, and we appreciate it. Y'all have a great night.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.